everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 25th of March 2015, and I am delighted once again to welcome back to the programme, exactly 1 year, as it happens, after our previous conversation with him, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who, of course, is very widely known and indeed very widely respected and appreciated by listeners to alternative media. He's one of the most distinguished and highly sought-after commentators on geopolitics and economic matters. He is the chairman of the Institute of Political Economy, with a career that spanned academia, journalism, business and public service. He has held numerous senior academic positions in universities. He was an associate editor and columnist for the Wall Street Journal and was appointed by President Reagan as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy during Reagan's first term in office, after which he served as a consultant to both the US Department of Defense and the US Department of Commerce. Dr. Roberts, thank you ever so much for joining us yet again on The Mind Renewed. It's wonderful to speak to you.
That's always a pleasure to speak with you, Julian.
Well, it really is great to be speaking with you again, because I know that people very much enjoy what you have to say. I mean, every time that you come on, I get emails from people saying that you've helped them to, you know, kind of make sense of what's going on in this world, this, I have to say, increasingly mad world, as indeed you've been a help to me over the years. So I do thank you for the work that you've done and continue to do. But I mean, if I'm right, you did say a few years ago that you were retiring from all of this. So what is it that keeps you going?
Well, I did try to retire. I resigned my syndications with Creative Syndicate in Los Angeles and retired, but I got chewed out by readers with thousands of emails pleading, begging, denouncing. And so I made a deal. I said, okay, I'm going to form up a website, and if you support it, I'll write. If you don't, I won't. And so far, they've been supporting it, and it's grown and grown. So I kind of got called out of retirement by my readers, who refused to let go. So I decided if that meant that much to them, I should continue.
Well, it's very good of you to be doing this. Do you feel like you're getting any retirement, or do you feel that you're being worked by all these people asking you to comment on things all the time?
Well, it shows me that, at least among, you know, part of the population, it's worldwide too, because the interest is worldwide. People want to know. They're dissatisfied. They know they're being lied to. And they have all these suspicions about what's really happening, but they don't know. And it just so happened the unusual career I had, I have a great deal of experience and was involved with all the main actors, including the ones today. So it kind of makes sense. And so I do try to give my 2 cents worth.
Well, it's very good of you to keep doing that. And of course, that's what I want to do today. I want to tap your expertise and your experience, because the subject that I want to ask you about today is this ongoing tension, as I'm calling it, between Washington and Moscow. How we've come to this position, how we're to understand what's actually going on at the moment, and what you think the future holds as events unfold. And I want to start by referencing a recent speech that you, in fact, highlighted at paulcraigroberts.org. This is a speech by Dr. Stephen Cohen, who is professor of Russian, well, he's emeritus professor of Russian studies at New York University and Princeton University. And in this, I think it's a remarkable speech, he heavily criticizes Washington's aggressive stance towards Russia and its demonization of Vladimir Putin. And he identifies what he calls a winner-takes-all policy towards Russia, which he says is based on a false analogy to the situation at the end of the Second World War. So just as Germany and Japan were subjugated by the Allies immediately after World War II, so with the end of the Cold War, Russia is to be denied an international sphere of influence in the post-Soviet era, and it's only the US that's to be allowed to have global influence. And he says that this doctrine is not new. It goes back to the Clinton era, he says. And much of what he says, I think, coheres with what you've been saying for a long time now about the neocons and their ideology of world hegemony, and you know, how they've come to dominate the US, US foreign policy in particular. So could I start by asking you to tell us where and when this neocon ideology originated, and how is it that it's come to wield quite so much influence over Washington?
The neoconservatives, I think that was a name they gave themselves. The origin of these people is the communist left. They were Trotskyites, and they were romantic in the sense of world revolution. You may remember that was the big argument between Trotsky and Stalin, that Trotsky wanted to use the Russian base to make the revolution international, and Stalin said that's foolish, socialism in one country. So the neoconservatives were leftists who were tinged with this romantic notion of world revolution. And it turned out it didn't matter whether it was communist or capitalist, as long as it was a world revolution.
Did you say it didn't matter whether it was communist or capitalist, did you say?
Yeah.
Right.
See, in the end, right. The thing is, these people didn't have a home, and they were able to infiltrate the conservatives in America because the conservatives were constantly ridiculed and marginalized by the liberals as anti-communists. So being an anti-communist meant that you were dope and wanted to blow up the world. And the conservatives thought they were just trying to stand up for freedom and democracy against the Soviet tyranny. The tyranny was highly imagined. I mean, there was some tyranny, but they had all these dystopia views of what was going to happen to us. You know, the Soviet Union was going to impose 1984 on us and all of that. And so when the neocons started making overtures to the conservatives said, hey, look, the left wing agrees with us. And so they welcomed them with open arms. And it didn't take the neoconservatives long to take over the conservative movement. They essentially decimated the original conservative movement. The conservatives have lost control of their publications, of their foundations. And it's all in the hands of the neocons. Now, they made their first appearance inside the government in the Reagan years. And none of us understood them at the time. We thought they were just anti-Soviet allies who would support the efforts to end the Cold War. You know, Reagan's plan was always to put all this pressure on the Soviets with the belief that their economy couldn't stand an arms race in order to pressure them to come to agreement to end the Cold War. That was the Reagan strategy. The reason for Nicaragua thing, the Grenada thing, all this was to show the Russians that there weren't going to be any more expansion, no more left-wing allies of Russia, and certainly not in the New World. And so the neocons could use all of that to work their way into the government. So they got many powerful positions, a lot of experience, a lot of contacts. And of course, they were heavily supported by Israel and the military security complex because of the profitability of all these Star Wars and stuff like that, which was really just a bluff.
And did they at the time come over as extreme in their views? Was that obvious?
No, not initially. But they got in trouble. The Iran-Contra thing blew up in their face. They were all fired. Some of them were prosecuted. Even the Secretary of Defense, Weinberger, was up for indictment. But they were all pardoned, not by Reagan, but by George Herbert Walker Bush, when he succeeded Reagan as the next president. And so, pardoned, they went into the think tank mode, and they took over various think tanks, and they developed these position papers. And their biggest advance came from the collapse of the Soviet Union. That was unexpected. The CIA had no idea of that. And in a way, it was a fluke. You know, it originated in the right-wing commies arresting Gorbachev. You know, if they just left him alone, this whole thing wouldn't have happened. But when they tried to arrest him, that broke up the system, and Yeltsin came in. And Yeltsin was a drunkard and an American stooge. So the collapse of Soviet power, the collapse of Russian power, you know, and we quickly dismembered the Russian Empire. You know, we took Ukraine out of it, Georgia out of it, and the Baltic states, and basically dismembered it, and Yeltsin was essentially a vassal. So Russia was no longer, it didn't even have an independent policy. And this gave rise to the notion that history had chosen America, and that there was no alternative, and that since we were chosen by history, then we could impose our will on the world. And this was the neoconservative announcement of American hegemony, you know, the unipower. And they came up with doctrines, for example, the Wolfowitz doctrine, which said that the principal purpose of American foreign policy henceforth is to prevent the rise of any other state, such as Russia, that could in any way interfere with American purposes in the world. In other words, the United States was to have the ability for unilateral intervention anywhere.
So this was in the 1990s that this was written?
That was the early 1990s. I think the Wolfowitz Doctrine was 1992. And this is the basis today of American foreign and military policy.
Can I just check with you, because I think that I might have accessed the actual quote for that. Is it a document called Defense Planning Guidance, 1992 draft?
Probably.
The quote I have here fits what you've just said. Let me just say what it says. Our first objective is to prevent the reemergence of a new rival, either on the territory of the former Soviet Union or elsewhere, that poses a threat on the order of that posed formerly by the Soviet Union. This is a dominant consideration underlying the new regional defense strategy and requires that we endeavour to prevent any hostile power from dominating a region whose resources would, under consolidated control, be sufficient to generate global power.
Yeah, that's the Wolfowitz penned that. He was a high Pentagon official by then. And you have to know what hostile power means. Hostile power means anybody who can have an independent policy.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they're going to attack us or get into a conflict with us. It means that any country that's powerful enough to defend its interests. And that's what hostile means in that context. So they had Russia under control. Now, a simple way of explaining what happened, to keep it brief, is the neocons launched their wars of conquest in the Middle East. They had all these utopian expectations. You might remember the Iraqi war was supposed to be, what, a six-week cakewalk or a three-week cakewalk? You know,
okay.
Went on 8 years. Mm. They went into Afghanistan, and Bush lands on the carrier and says, mission accomplished. Well, the thing had hardly started. It's been going on 14 years, and we are unable to defeat a few thousand lightly armed Taliban who now control the country again. Mm. So we got mired down in these things based on the belief that it would be over with in just hours, you know. And during that time, Putin came along and restored the Russian military power, economic power, and began defending Russian interest. And the neocons became aware of this when their plans to invade Syria were blocked and their plans to bomb Iran were blocked because the Russians said no.
So Putin was actually treading right against the Wolfowitz Doctrine.
Yeah. Yeah, and so all of a sudden they realized that their first objective had been breached. Yeah. And so they instantly went into the anti-Russian phase, the denunciation of Putin. You know, until that time, he was very much liked and appreciated. He helped us when the Pakistanis blocked our troop movements into Afghanistan because we kept shooting up their country and not apologizing. He let us go in through Russia to Afghanistan. He supported all our anti-terrorist stuff. The Russians were being very cooperative, but it didn't mean they were going to just abandon their interest altogether. And so when they refused to do that, all of a sudden the neocons went berserk and they said, look, we've made a mistake. Here they are. They're back. We got to do something about them. And that's where the Ukraine thing came from. So we destabilized the Ukraine because that's a good way to really put pressure on Russia. And they were able to use the destabilization of Ukraine, you know, the American coup there, in order to break up Russian political and economic relations with Europe. Yeah. That's what the sanctions were for. They told everybody the sanctions are to hurt the Russian economy, but obviously they haven't. What they hurt was the Russian-European economic and political relationship. So Washington was mainly concerned that Europe would be pulled out of Washington's orbit by the developing economic and political relationships with Russia, particularly the Europeans' dependency on Russian energy. So that's what the Ukraine was about. Now, if it hadn't been for the Soviet collapse, we probably wouldn't have had this doctrine of American unipower, you know, that history has chosen us. Yeah. It's really a counterpart to Marx's view that history had chosen the proletariat.
Right. So it immediately reminds me of that sort of Hegelian view of the or spiritual supremacy of the state and perhaps one day being extrapolated to the world state. That's the kind of thinking that immediately comes to mind.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, that's it.
Yeah. Well, I want to come back to Russia, obviously, in a moment, but I did want to take the opportunity to ask you about this project of the neocons called the Project for a New American Century, which I get the impression grew out of the defense planning guidance that you've been talking about, because it was asking, you know, we need to rebuild America's defenses, which was their publication from the year 2000. And in that, they say that what's needed in order to justify this rebuilding of defenses, as they put it, is something that they call, and I'm going to quote from them, some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And of course, 1 year later, 9/11 turned out to be precisely that new Pearl Harbor. So do you think that that was another decisive point for the neocons? You know, they effectively staged a coup by at least seizing that opportunity if they didn't actually bring it about themselves.
Of course, yeah. It was used for that. And the neocons were placed in the government at that time, in particular in the security agencies and in the Pentagon, you know, the defense agencies, to have been able to pull that off. And of course, Cheney was their man, and he was the vice president. And if you remember, for some curious reason, Bush was not present in Washington that day. Mm. He had been sent off to read children's stories in a school somewhere and was kept out of Washington. So it all looks, you know, it's such a collection of circumstance that it does look like it's something they pulled off, particularly since the resistance to any inquiry was powerful and lasted for a whole year. Till finally the 9/11 families themselves were able to force a nominal inquiry, which consisted of a bunch of politicians listening to the government story and writing it down. That's all the 9/11 Commission did. And the 9/11 Commission itself, both the chairman, the co-chairman, and the legal counsel have written books saying that they were lied to, that the 9/11 Commission was set up to fail, that they considered bringing felony charges against the government officials who had lied to them and so on and so on. But it's never gotten any attention. It's quite an amazing thing when the chairman, co-chairman, chief legal counsel say that this whole thing was a farce and nothing happens.
Indeed. Yeah, yeah. But would you say that that was the kind of turning point where that neocon ideology really took over the center of the American establishment? Because when I was listening to Crosstalk on RT, and there was a very good talk about what was going on in Russia, and one of the things that came up was this neocon matter, and they were saying on this program that, you know, that it's influenced think tanks and academia and media and the corporate world. You know, it seems like you don't get anywhere these days unless you sort of buy into that.
They had already taken over. They'd already taken over all that. What 9/11 did was to let them start the wars. Right. And the reason they wanted the buildup in defense, which on its face made no sense because the Soviet power had collapsed. And everybody said at that time, they all said, oh, it'll take China 50 years to develop. So we essentially had no enemies. There was no reason to even have a defense budget. And yet they were very adamant that we had to spend even more than when we faced the Soviet challenge. And the reason was they were trying to build up the armies for these wars. And it's really, the neocons have the world divided up into six commands. The United States government even has an Africa command. So we've got the whole world targeted for U.S. control, military control, invasion, occupation. And that's why they wanted to build up the budget, even though there was no sign of any enemies anywhere. And the wars were already planned. You can't possibly mount an invasion of Afghanistan as rapidly as it happened between 9/11 and the invasion. You already had to have stuff there. And the same for Iraq. You may remember that Bush's first Secretary of the Treasury, who was not one of the banksters, he said the first cabinet meeting he went to, they were talking about invading Iraq. It was before 9/11. So all of that was already arranged and the schedule was there. And the whole strike against the Middle East was to get rid of the non-puppet states, the states that were independent of the U.S., Iraq, Syria, Iran, and Libya and North Africa. These were the targets because they're not American puppets like Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. So that's the story of that. They already had plans to attack Iraq before 9/11. the Secretary of the Treasury made that clear in public statements.
And Russia, of course, is very well aware of all this and is also conscious that it is being targeted itself in various ways and on various fronts. And I'm thinking here of a recent interview that I heard with Noam Chomsky. This is on Democracy Now! And he was saying that whatever we might think about Vladimir Putin, he has a point. Russia has a case. And he points to the dialogue between George H.W. Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev back in 1989, when it was agreed that NATO should not expand, and this is the quote that he brought out, 1 inch to the east, meaning obviously towards Russia. But he says almost immediately that's exactly what started to happen. And that process has continued up to the point where we now, of course, have NATO troops or NATO sympathetic troops, you know, right up against the Russian Federation border. I mean, did you think that promise was ever really made in good faith in the first place?
Yes, I think it was. You know, Reagan and Gorbachev worked everything out.
Right.
And the problem of the Cold War and maybe a nuclear war was over. And this was reiterated by Bush and his Secretary of State, Jim Baker. And Jim Baker gave these explicit promises. I'm just trying to remember, I think what Gorbachev said is, if I let the Berlin Wall come down, does this mean you guys are going to bring your forces up to our borders? And they promised absolutely not. What it was, I think, was the unification of Germany.
Right.
If we Soviets allow the unification of Germany and we pull out, does that mean that your troops are going to be out on our border? And he was given absolute total assurances. Now, he didn't get it written down.
It was just a verbal agreement.
In those days, that's all you needed, because one government respected the next government's deals. I remember when we went in, when I went in the Treasury, the first thing we were confronted with was a bailout of the American automobile industry. Quotas were going to be put on Japanese cars. They couldn't sell but so many in America until General Motors and Ford and Chrysler recovered. And, of course, that was totally against our policy. And I sent my staff to work immediately on blocking this. And was called in and explained that this is an agreement that Carter had already made for the car companies and the Japanese, and that we had to honor it, even though it was against our policy. And I was ordered to back off, which I did. So even the Reagan administration had to agree with something that it didn't agree with. You know, we were supposed to be a free trade type regime because it had been already agreed by Carter. So normally, that's all it takes. And I think Gorbachev was simply delighted, like Reagan was, to have ended the conflict and didn't expect. Nobody knew about the neocons. And Gorbachev himself didn't expect the Soviet Union was going to collapse. You know, it was his liberalization that caused the hardline commies to arrest him. That's what broke the system up. That destabilized everything. I mean, the system was failing economically. But it wasn't simply going to disappear. It was that stupid act by the hardline communists.
So you agree then with Noam Chomsky that Russia does have this case to be very, very concerned about this eastward push that was to continue?
Oh, it's a much stronger case. It's much stronger than Chomsky makes, because not only were they promised no eastward expansion of NATO, the Bush people pulled out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. They simply abandoned the treaty. Because the neocons said, look, we can put up ABM bases on their borders and neutralize their strategic deterrent, and then we can make them do whatever we want. So this was a huge blow. And then the neocons changed American war doctrine. Our war doctrine had always been that nuclear weapons were only in retaliation to an attack by nuclear weapons. The Bush regime turned it into a preemptive strike. And not only a preemptive strike, but it can be used against non-nuclear countries. So now the Russians faced NATO on their borders, the abolition of the ABM treaty, ABM bases going up on their borders, and an American war doctrine that permits preemptive nuclear attack. And it gets worse from there. So all of these things are pressed on Russia, and they've been very unprovocative.
You understand that everything that Russia is doing then is defensive?
It always is. They are a defensive country. If you look at it history-wise, they don't go around attacking people. They might, if they see everybody's massed on their border about to attack them, they might hit first. But they are defensive, and they're always getting overrun initially, you know, Napoleon, Hitler. But it's a huge place, and they have a view of themselves that the West doesn't have of itself. And you just don't defeat them. They're not defeatable.
You see, what you're expressing here is exactly the opposite, of course, that we're getting on the mainstream media. I mean, if I turn to the BBC's profile of Vladimir Putin, it says that he has nostalgia for the USSR, and that particular article links to a previous article called Putin Deplores Collapse of USSR, and it says, Russia's President Vladimir Putin has described the collapse of the Soviet Union as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. And the whole thing seems to be, you know, giving this message that really what Putin wants to do is to expand this empire and resurrect the Soviet Union. I mean, do you think there's anything at all to that narrative?
Yes, that's CIA propaganda, and they pay the BBC to broadcast it. Did you know about this book by the German editor of the big newspaper in Germany who said that he was paid by the CIA to publish under his name stories they handed him? And he said every important journalist in Europe is on the CIA payroll.
Right. This is Dr. Udo Ulf Kotter, is that right?
Yeah, that's him. Yeah. And no one is, you know, and if this isn't true, they could libel. He could be subject to libel. Nobody's brought a case. He says, I welcome it. Bring the case. I can prove everything. And the BBC, what do? They just lie for the Americans. That's all they are. BBC is part of the American propaganda ministry. Well, it's not a news organization. It's a propaganda organization. What they say about Putin is a total lie. Look, remember a few years back when the Americans and the Israelis went in, trained the Georgian army, gave it its war plans, gave it the okay to attack South Ossetia. Now, South Ossetia is a breakaway part of Georgia. They didn't want to leave Russia. And there are peacekeeping troops in South Ossetia at the time, both Georgian and Russian, to stop conflict. So the Americans and the Israelis, sent the Georgian army that they trained and equipped in, and they attacked South Ossetia. They kill Russian peacekeepers. They kill population, Russian people. Putin was at the Olympics in Beijing. He came right back. The Russian army went right in. The whole thing was over in 5 hours. The entire Georgia was in Putin's hands. If he'd wanted the stinking place, he could have put it right back into Russia, where it had been for centuries. Georgia was part of Russia for centuries. It's the birthplace of Joseph Stalin. The Americans broke it out when the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia was weak. So if he had wanted to rebuild the empire, he just kept it because he had it. It was right there. The Georgian army didn't last 5 hours with all its American training and arms. It collapsed and he had the whole country. So what did he do? He stopped the attack on the South Ossetians and pulled the troops out and went home. If he wanted the Ukraine, he could take it in 24 hours. There's nobody could do anything about it. Certainly not NATO, not the United States, certainly not Ukraine.
You're convinced that he doesn't actually want Ukraine?
He doesn't want it. He's made it clear he doesn't want it. He doesn't even want the breakaway republics. He doesn't want the Donetsk Republic, the Luhansk Republic. He wants them to stay part of Ukraine. He just wants them to be given the autonomy that they demand to be part of the Ukraine. He sees them as a stabilizing part of the population of Ukraine and balance the crazy Nazis in the western Ukraine, which basically have the government in Kiev. The eastern and southern Ukraine are former parts of Russia. You know, Ukraine has also been part of Russia for centuries. I mean, longer than the United States exists.
Your understanding then is that he doesn't actually want the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine to actually become part of modern Russia.
No.
You know, he wants a neutral Ukraine with no alliances, just regions within this neutral zone.
That's right. You know, when both the independent republics voted overwhelmingly to rejoin Russia, as did Crimea, he said no. Now, he's not going to stand for those Russian people to be bombed and blown up. He's certainly not going to stand for NATO bases in Ukraine.
So do you think, therefore, he has actually been arming the separatists?
No, I don't think he's armed them. He hasn't needed to because they just simply seized all the Ukrainian arsenals there. You know, if there were Russian forces in Ukraine, the war would have been over 6 months ago. There's no possibility of the Ukraine fighting Russia. There's none at all. And he's made no effort. I mean, you know, the KGB hasn't assassinated all those Nazis that we have running around Kiev. They haven't sent a Hellfire missile after that fat stooge that we stuck in as president. They haven't done anything. They've tried to resolve it diplomatically. In fact, on several occasions, they forced the republics who were on the verge of dramatic military victories to stop in the interest of trying to get a peace deal going. And they're committed to this Minsk thing that Merkel of Germany and Hollande of France went to Putin to put together because they're concerned about the Americans pushing this to war.
Also, the claim was made, of course, that somehow he was, in a kind of distant way, responsible.
Julian, the claim is to justify the American aggression. The claim is to justify. See, now what has the Congress done? It's voted a resolution that President Obama should send offensive military equipment to Ukraine. Well, that will explode the situation. And everybody knows it. And the Russians have said, why are you going to do this? This explodes the situation. We're trying to resolve it. In other words, the idiot Americans and the idiot British, I mean, I swear to God, your prime minister is the biggest fool I've ever known of. These people are trying to start a war with Russia. Why? They can't defeat the Taliban, and they're going to take on Russia.
I have to say, whatever respect I had for David Cameron vanished a few months ago when the United Nations criticised anybody who might question 9/11, 7/7, things like that, you know, as being somehow connected with terrorism. I just thought that was appalling.
He's an American vassal. All your prime ministers are vassals. Tony Blair was a vassal. The guy before him was a vassal. They're American vassals. They don't represent England. They represent Washington.
MH17, of course, in a kind of distanced way, was blamed on Putin as well. Do you think we're ever going to get to know, from official sources anyway, the truth about what happened there?
No, the United States will simply not allow it. I mean, they already know what happened. It was shot down by one of the Ukrainian fighters. And various experts have said you can see it because both sides of the fuselage, where the cabin of the plane is, are riddled with machine gun fire. Everybody knows, but the United States is not going to let any report come out. I mean, you think they don't know by now?
No, I didn't say I didn't think they know by now, but it's, you know, when I turn to, again, to my favourite source for such questioning, to the BBC, I find an article that suggests that the most reasonable interpretation is that, of course, it was a missile that exploded before it hit the aircraft, created a lot of shrapnel, and caused damage exactly the same as you might expect from a machine gun.
No, it wouldn't be, because shrapnel, the holes would be irregular, and machine gun bullet holes are very definite and round. Unless the idiot at the BBC thinks that shrapnel blows up in little bullet-shaped balls. They may. I have no respect whatsoever for the BBC. Julian, it's a disinformation war. It's just like what the United States did to Saddam Hussein, to Gaddafi, to Assad, what they've tried to do to Iran. They tell a bunch of lies. They demonize. And yet everybody keeps falling for it. We now know Saddam Hussein did not have any weapons of mass destruction. We now know that the Bush regime knew that at the time. We know that all the lies they told about Gaddafi are lies, and that the Obama regime knew that at the time. We know that Assad did not use chemical weapons. We know that the United States knew that at the time. We know that Iran does not have nukes or a nuclear weapons program. We've known that for years. All 16 American intelligence agencies said their nuclear program came to an end early in the 21st century. And the International Atomic Energy Agency that monitors all of that, they've never been able to find any diversion of uranium, enriched uranium, to a weapons program. In fact, the Iranians aren't even able to enrich uranium to the level necessary to make a nuclear weapon. So the whole thing is, it's been lies. It's just constant lies. We know that the Russians have not invaded Ukraine. If they had, they would have it. Ukraine can't do anything about it. These are the most blatant, transparent lies in human history. And for the BBC to repeat them, it shows a completely corrupted news organization. There's no basis for any of these claims. They're all blatant, transparent lies.
What do you make of the claim that we constantly hear that this is a new Cold War?
It's not a Cold War.
Well, this is what Ambassador Jack Matlock said. You had a link to a presentation that he gave on your website, and he was saying that it's not analogous to the Cold War at all.
He's right. You see, he's a very experienced guy and highly intelligent and honest. He doesn't want anything from the establishment, so he can tell the truth. If you want anything from the establishment or your career depends on it, you can't possibly tell the truth. This is why there are so few truth tellers.
And he says that it's not the Cold War because it's not ideological in the sense that there isn't a fight against Soviet communism.
They don't even want the conflict. They've done everything they could to resolve this diplomatically. And as Putin says over and over and over, Washington simply doesn't respond. I come up with a diplomatic initiative, and they tell more lies. You remember what happened the first time he enforced a peace agreement on the breakaway republics in Ukraine. We increased the sanctions. So this is a provocation by the United States, or by Washington. This is Washington's relentless provocation of Russia, who has done nothing. Crimea is Russian. It's been part of Russia since the time of Catherine the Great. In 1954, Khrushchev, a Ukrainian, to make up for being the butcher of the Ukraine, you know, apparently he was responsible for 600,000 deaths. And to woo back his home country, he broke Crimea out of the Russian Republic and stuck it in the Ukrainian Socialist Soviet Republic. That's how the Ukraine got Crimea. It's not part of Ukraine, never has been. The people are not Ukrainians. Now, one of the reasons Washington wanted to grab Ukraine was to grab Crimea, because that's where the Soviet naval base is. It's the only warm water port that the Russians have ever had. It's on the Black Sea, and they can come out through the straits into the Mediterranean. And so the whole military intent of grabbing Ukraine was to force the Russians out of the naval base, even though it was part of Ukraine, the Russians had a long-term lease on the base, and they had in Crimea, under the treaty, 25,000 troops. And the troops that are said to have invaded Crimea was simply the Russian garrison that's been there forever.
Yeah, and I know I asked this of you last time, but of course the point was made that the decision made by the Crimean people was at gunpoint, and that it was not done in a constitutional way, and all these kinds of points were made. But of course, you did answer that last time.
That's just part of the American propaganda. You see, look, Julian, let's cut to the chase. What's so wrong about the propaganda is it's driving the world to a nuclear war. NATO and the United States have no prospect whatsoever of winning a conventional war with Russia. If we send an army in there, it's going to be utterly destroyed. And so the humiliation of the defeat will cause Washington to move the thing nuclear. So when you have the BBC lying through its teeth in order to support the Americans, you have the BBC driving the world to nuclear war. That's what they're doing. And they need to be aware of this. At some point, you know, you got to think, do you have some obligation to life on Earth, to the planet? Or are you just going to lie through your teeth because the Americans want you to and probably are paying the money? I mean, according to that German editor, they're all paid off. So you're talking about a media that's corrupt and that is taking risk with the existence of life on Earth. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about whether they have a case or not, or did Russia do this or did Russia do that. We're talking about lies that are driving the world to nuclear war. That is what we're talking about. We need to be clear about that. Your listeners need to be clear. They need to understand that this is not a question of whether Russia did this or did that, or who told the truth about this or did that, or whether they both sides are responsible. When you get this systematic lies and demonization, you're driving the world toward war.
I have to say, there is something actually of that in Putin's speech that he gave in 2006 at the Munich Security Conference, where he said some stark things, which no doubt ruffled a lot of feathers at the time. But I think, you know, there's an awful lot of truth in what he said there. And he pointed specifically to the anti-ballistic missile systems seeming to creep eastward in Europe. And, you know, he was saying how the idea of a unipolar world was just unacceptable, that it's a fiction, it can't work. And he was complaining about the illegal actions of Washington, etc. The current situation we're facing now, it's almost as if he was anticipating that back then.
He could see where it was going. Just look at the hubris and arrogance of the neoconservatives. They've now driven Russia and China together. You got two massive nuclear powers. Either of those countries can destroy the whole world. So now the idiots in Washington are in conflict with two large countries, one with the largest population in the world, the other with the largest landmass in the world, both armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. This is what the fools in Washington have done, and their puppets, particularly the British Prime Minister. I mean, he's the worst puppet of them all. So they have brought the world to the brink of war. There's no way the United States can invade China. The army would disappear, or Russia. Oh, look, Napoleon couldn't do it. The Wehrmacht couldn't do it. You know, Hitler's powerful army. It just got chewed to pieces. Nobody can do that. And so the war has to be nuclear. And that's why you have the first strike thing. Plus, you have all this fantastic utopian ideas about how the ABM is going to protect us. It's not. The Russians can take every one of them out with cruise missiles. All the ABM sites will be the first thing that goes out. So we're talking about death of the world. That's what Washington is driving the world to. Death, total death. And why? Because we are the only power, and we're not going to have a situation where anybody can get in our way. And all this is dressed up as humanism and democracy and blah, blah, blah. It's madness. It's insanity. And the British government's hand in glove with it, though not necessarily the parliament. You have to remember your own parliament. When Obama was about to invade Syria, they said, no, we're not going to be part of it. And your prime minister couldn't do anything about it. So it's a very serious situation. It's really not a question of whether Putin has a point or not. The question is he going to surrender? And is China going to surrender and be vassals like Britain and Canada and Australia and Germany and France and Italy? Unless Russia and China are going to surrender and be American vassal states, there's going to be a war. Now, some people may say, well, the Russians, Chinese are far more humane than the Americans, and they will surrender in order to avoid the war. That's entirely possible. Putin might do that. He's far more humane than anything in the West. But I doubt he would be allowed, because the Russian, he's not a dictator. He has to answer to powerful interest groups in Russia. The Russian nationalists are not going to surrender.
But you would agree that he's authoritarian?
I would not. Russia is far more democratic than the United States. In fact, so is China. There's no democracy in the United States. There are 5 or 6 interest groups, private interest groups around the country. It's an oligarchy here. Voting is meaningless. It's a waste of time to vote at any level. It has no impact on anything.
Well, I actually picked up that word authoritarian from Stephen Cohen. He said that. He didn't think that he was a dictator because, as you said, he's accountable to many interests in Russia. But nevertheless, he thought he's authoritarian in spirit.
Stephen Cohen is our best Russian expert, but he has to survive in the discussion. So he has to accept a lot of BS just to be part of it. Okay. If he doesn't accept any of the BS, they're not going to listen to him. He's not have a forum. You know, he was already viciously attacked in one of the left-wing publications. He was called a Putin stooge. Some two-bit punk journalist is calling our most distinguished Russian expert names. So that's why Stephen Cohen says things like that. He's just trying to modify his position so that he can say some things. And that's all it means. He knows good and well Putin is not an authoritarian.
And yet it has to be said that he does have this KGB background, and many people point to mafia connections.
Oh, George Bush was a CIA director and president of the United States. Did you ever hear anybody say that? He was director of the CIA.
That's a very good point.
And he becomes president. Putin was not the head of the KGB. He was some sort of mid-level intelligence operative. It's just an intelligence agency. The deadly Russian secret police was a Stalinist one. The KGB was a successor. And he's not mafia. Didn't you see that article that they wrote? Putin was the deputy mayor of, what, St. Petersburg or something?
Yes, I did.
And his net worth is $5,000. And they said, how in the world can this guy be the deputy mayor of St. Petersburg and not be worth millions and millions? He was worth $5,000. So it's just all BS. It's all propaganda. It's all just a bunch of lies. There's no confirmation for anything that's said about him.
I want to bring up something else that you mentioned at your website, where you say that while the Minsk II talks were underway, Washington was busy sending various people to places like Armenia and Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, various people like Victoria Nuland, and you mentioned Richard Miles acting as a U.S. ambassador, and the reason why these people were being sent there was to bring about color revolutions there. So could I ask you to comment on that?
It's what's driving the conflict. See, Washington thinks that it can destabilize Russia and China, and therefore all this pressure it's putting on them won't come to a war fruition, because Washington tends to destabilize them by creating color revolutions all along their borders in former Soviet territories. So Nuland is dispatched to Armenia, Miles to Kyrgyzstan, because these are prospective places for these color revolutions. Washington is funding all these NGOs in these countries, which are essentially fifth columns, and Uzbekistan, all of his other kinds of possibilities. Because if they can get turmoil on China's border, then those breakaway, that Muslim province that China has, can become unstable. So this is what Washington is banking on. You know, they had a color revolution in Georgia. They had one in Ukraine, and I think it was 2004, and it didn't work. It worked, but it didn't deliver Ukraine. So they spent 10 years building up NGOs, grooming politicians to take over, and then they had their coup last year.
So the idea then is that they will gradually weaken Moscow.
Yeah,
is that the idea? So that's what they're banking
on. That's the idea. They caused them so much trouble on their borders in what used to be part of the country, you know, part of the Soviet Union. In fact, I guess at various times, the Russian Empire itself had some of these lands. They certainly had Georgia and Ukraine.
So if it can play out on that level, then why would there ever be any need to go nuclear, which when everybody knows that that's just disaster?
Well, it depends on what the Russian response is, and it depends on how hard they push. Suppose they pull off color revolution in Armenia and Kyrgyzstan, and they bust up oil pipeline plans and flows, and you don't know, you know, the Americans are very devious. They're up to all kinds of things. So, I mean, Washington. I don't mean Americans. I have a foggiest idea what's going on with Washington. So then they start putting more pressure on Russia. They say, okay, we're going to put NATO bases in Ukraine. Well, that's going to do it. When you're ruled by arrogance and hubris, and think that you have a God-given right to rule the earth, you do all kinds of crazy stuff. You push too hard. And that's just normal. You know, look how bullies behave. You know, eventually they find somebody they can't bully. So it's a dangerous situation whether they destabilize Armenia and Kyrgyzstan or not. In fact, that just makes it more dangerous. It makes it more obvious to the Russians and the Chinese that they're targeted. Even their so-called liberal pro-American groups can't pretend any longer. You know, both countries have, I mean, both Russia and China have these pro-American groups there. They're assiduously cultivated by Washington. And the whole purpose is to cause more internal trouble. You may remember when Putin was reelected, we were able to call out that big demonstration in Moscow claiming he had stole the election. There was no evidence whatsoever he stole the election. All the current polls showing he has at least 85% of public support as an indication he didn't steal anything. And yet we were able to put into the streets of Moscow tens of thousands of people making that claim. So both countries are infiltrated.
I also wanted to ask you about the murder of Boris Nemtsov. And one of the things that struck me about that is, you know, as soon as that shooting had taken place, the mainstream media reports were implying, of course, that Putin was behind it. And my immediate reaction was to ask that, you know, the cui bono question. The answer, in my mind anyway, was not Putin. Why would he do that? You know, that would seem to invite accusations from across the globe. Whether you like him or not, I don't think he's a stupid man. And yet, the very next morning, as I was watching Sky News, both the reporter and the interviewee were saying that there were really only a handful of reasonable possibilities, that Putin was behind it, that the ultra-nationalists inspired by Putin's Russia had done it, or business people whom Nemtsov had criticized had done this. And any other possibility was tagged with that phrase, conspiracy theory, conspiracy theory. So it was in three times in that conversation. I sat there thinking to myself that the most obvious possibility was that it was some kind of false flag event to be blamed on Putin. And apparently that was considered irrational. And I just sat there thinking, this is just a crazy situation to be in. Do you think that's an irrational thing that I was thinking there?
No, it's the most likely explanation. This guy was no longer relevant. I mean, he had zero support. He was not in any way a rival to Putin or any way dangerous to the Russian government. So when you get a guy like that and he's your man, sometimes he's worth more to your dead. So he could easily have been assassinated by the CIA. On the other hand, it could have been some personal business because, you know, he was apparently a ladies' man and sometimes the ladies were somebody else's. He may have simply just tread on toes of people who were a lot tougher than he was.
Right. I wasn't asking you to say what it actually was. I just thought that it's at least rational to consider that it might have been a setup.
Yeah, it's the first thing that comes into any experienced person's mind. The first thing. It's like you say, it's nonsensical for Putin to do it. Everybody knows that. It has an ounce of sense. So it was a propaganda show. It was a propaganda show no matter who did it. It doesn't mean just because it was a propaganda show that the CIA did it.
Sure.
It could easily have been he just crossed somebody that got tired of him because he does seem to have been sort of full of himself and a ladies' man, you know, and he was with some babe at the time it happened. It's just really not clear. I mean, it could have just been somebody settling the score.
And I noticed actually in one newspaper there was a reference made to Litvinenko's wife somehow. I think she was implying that Putin was behind it. Do you consider the Litvinenko business being dragged up again after all these years as also part of the propaganda?
Yeah, it's part of the propaganda. Mm. Yeah. The propaganda didn't make any sense because, okay, Putin is a dictator or he's authoritarian. Well, if he wants to get somebody, he can just pick him up and frame him, put him in jail. He doesn't need to shoot him on the street. If he's so authoritarian, as the BBC and all these idiots say, then all these guys do is have him picked up and just present him with a charge. I mean, even the United States can do that. We pick up people all the time and present them with charges, and there's no evidence, and we hold them indefinitely. And we torture them. We torture them for years, and they're held indefinitely in torture, or we send a Hellfire missile to assassinate them, including American citizens.
And instead of that, he does something which is the worst possible thing to do from the point of view of publicity.
Yeah. If he wants the guy, he could just arrest him.
Yeah.
I'm sure they can find something he's guilty of. So it's unbelievable because if he was any kind of a problem for Putin, they would have simply made a case against him. If Putin is this authoritarian figure. So you can't have an authoritarian dictatorial type that has to resort to surreptitiously killing somebody on the street. That's not what they have to do. Just pick them up. As I said, even the so-called American democracy can do that. So what could authoritarian Russia do?
Do you think, nevertheless, there's some hope in Angela Merkel's distancing from Washington? I mean, there was that Der Spiegel article that was very critical of Philip Breedlove fairly recently, which was saying that he's very fear-mongering about Russia's alleged involvement in Ukraine, but there seems to be no evidence for the things that he's saying. But I noticed the comments were aimed at General Breedlove, but I'm picking up the vibes that really this is a distancing from Washington. Do you think there's some hope in that?
Well, there could be. You see, Merkel is an American puppet, but she is also subject to other forces, other pressures. And there's a tremendous opposition inside Germany to this conflict with Russia.
Yeah.
The business community, which is influential, sees nothing in it except loss of profits, maybe another defeat at the hands of Russia. I mean, they haven't forgotten what happened to them in World War II. they don't want anything to do with conflict with Russia. The German intelligence agencies, they're the ones who made it clear that Breedlove was lying through his teeth and there was no evidence whatsoever for his provocative statements. So she's got her own intelligence service telling her these Americans are crazy, they're insane, they're going to get us in a war with Russia. You got the business people saying, how many hundreds of thousands of our workers do you want laid off, unemployed, because you're sucking up to the Americans? So she has that counter pressure. And so she's having to adjust to that too. Where she comes out in the end, I don't know. We'll see.
But do you think there's a chance that Europe itself might be moving away from Washington in this respect? Because I understand that there's opposition to the renewal of sanctions against Russia coming from places like Spain and Greece, Cyprus, Bulgaria. Do you see some hope in that?
You can see hope in it. It really just depends on how much blackmail Washington has. I mean, you know, what the whole purpose of the NSA spying is to be able to blackmail every leader in the world. And when they're even listening to their personal cell phone calls, and they've got everything on everybody. So it really depends. So what, or it may come down to threats. You know, if it looked like Germany was, Merkel was going to take Germany out of NATO, she'd probably be assassinated.
Well, I did wonder if there was a veiled threat.
There always.
I heard it was George Friedman of Stratfor, who heads up Stratfor, in a video that I saw recently. He was saying that something like Europe doesn't exist anymore. And I think this was around the same kind of time as Minsk too. And he said we have a relationship with France or something. He said, but basically Europe's of no interest kind of thing. And I just wondered if that was reflecting, whether it was in fact some kind of threat there. I don't know.
There's always a veiled threat. And I think what he was saying is that Europe has been in American vassalage since 1945 and knows no other way of existence. The only country that has had an independent foreign policy in Europe was France under de Gaulle. All the other countries, I mean, England doesn't have an independent foreign policy, or Germany or Italy or Spain. They all do exactly what Washington tells them to do.
So do you think his was a kind of warning to say, don't think independently?
I think they never allowed to forget it. Don't you remember, I think it was last year sometime, there was some talk, both Germany and England, or England and one other country, I think it was Germany, but England, and of leaving the EU. And an assistant secretary somewhere called up and told the governments that they better not say that anymore. It wasn't in America's interest. It was even reported in the prostitute media. So when you have an assistant secretary of somewhere, state or defense or wherever it was, they can call up and tell so-called sovereign governments that they can't even mention possibility of leaving the EU and shut up. How much independence do these countries have? None. Now, are they going to find it? That's the question. Here's the question that you're really asking me, and that is, are the Americans putting so much stress on Europe by driving them into conflict with Russia that they can see no future in, that they actually break up from America? And yes, there is hope for that. There is hope that the Americans are pushing their vassals too much against their vassals' interest. Too much can lead them to say, well, you know, this doesn't serve us any longer. And whatever the cost, we're stopping it. So yes, there is hope, and that's why I say the danger and the hope both come from the arrogance and hubris of Washington.
Yeah, but I want to ask you about that, because if you do see there's some hope that Europe would disengage from this, it's interesting that I mentioned George Friedman, of course, this head of Stratfor, and he wrote a piece last year called From Estonia to Azerbaijan, American Strategy After Ukraine. And he was envisaging an alliance of nations stretching from Estonia in the north through a string of nations, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, right down through to Georgia, Azerbaijan, which you say would be a kind of buffer against, as he sees it, Russian expansionism. And he was saying that that would have to be independent of NATO, because Europe wouldn't be committed enough to that. So it would be essentially a US-funded and supported alliance of nations. So I was wondering whether he's actually got that kind of view actually in his mind there, that maybe Europe might not support this.
That's the neocon plan. It's even consistent with Brzezinski. His view was pre-neocon. It wasn't as drastic. And when they say it's Alliance of Nations, that's just cover. It is a puppet arrangement. And it's not to block Russian expansion. It's to advance Washington's expansion. Mm-hmm. Russia's not expanding anywhere.
Well, I did say as he sees it.
Yeah, well, as he sees it. Well, he doesn't see it that way either. That's as he says it in order to hide what's really happening. They pretend that Russia is expanding and they have to organize the world to contain Russia. But what they're really doing is organizing the world to serve Washington.
Okay, but what I found interesting about the way he put it was that he seemed to not exactly factor Europe out altogether, but limited the role of Europe, as if Europe was saying, well, we can't go that far, we're standing by the way. But he was saying the US would continue to fund this strip of nations without Europe, effectively.
Well, I wouldn't say that the United States is going to let Europe go. So we'll see. But it's just part of the aggression toward Russia. And China. You know, the same thing is happening with China. We've had this so-called pivot to Asia. We have all these plans for new air and naval bases ringing China. We're getting the Philippine naval base back. We want to build a new one on a protected Korean island. We're putting Marines in Australia. We're trying to get the Vietnam bases. We're doing everything we can to control the flow of resources through the South China Sea so that we can cut off materials into China. So this is just as dangerous as what we're doing to the Russians. It's madness, and it's all because Washington thinks it has this right to prevail over everybody and that nobody's interest counts but Washington's.
So it basically boils down to what you said in previous interviews in terms of there being any hope in this, and that is that the US comes crashing down because of financial collapse. In January this year, Michael Snyder published an article drawing attention to 11 notable economic commentators, and you were one of them, who were saying that they thought 2015 could well be the year for that to happen. Do you still think that this could be the year? And if so, do you think that paradoxically could be our greatest source of hope?
Yeah, we have two sources of hope. That's, you know, the American system is a house of cards. The economy is a house of cards. And the other system we've been talking about, the Washington may push so hard it drives Europe into independence. But let me just give you the February retail sales in the United States fell by 0.8%. At the annual level, retail sales in the United States are at recession level. At first quarter, real sales contracted 2.6%. This is the worst showing since the depths of the 2007-08 economic collapse. Real earnings are down again for the month.
All we ever seem to hear about, though, are the markets and how well they're doing.
And the reason the market's doing is because the Fed creates so much money, has got nowhere to go, and it drives up asset prices. So you have high bond prices, negative real interest rates. You have high stock prices that are not supported by earnings or anything else, but are just supported by the liquidity that's dumped into the system. Generally, that type of liquidity gets into the economy and drives up consumer prices into hyperinflation levels. But given the constraints on the debt levels, people can't borrow. They're too indebted. The banks are too busted to lend. So all the money goes into asset prices. So the whole thing is fake, artificial. You've got a situation where the middle class has shrunk because first they offshored all the blue-collar middle-class manufacturing jobs, well, not all of them, but a large percentage of them, and then they offshored the professional tradable skill jobs like software engineering, information technology that university graduates would take. Those jobs are all gone too. So we now have several graduating classes for several years now of college graduates who can't find employment. They go back home, live with their parents. So you have a university-educated population that's like used to be in India. They get jobs as waiters, as bartenders, as cab drivers. They can't form households on the income, so they can't buy houses. They can't get married. They can't buy home furnishings. They can't buy appliances. So there's no consumer basis for the economy. We see large retail stores closing down in these big chains like Sears, J.P. Penney. We see even the dollar stores in trouble. We see the massive shopping centers losing what are called anchor stores. That is the big retailer that occupies the biggest space in the shopping mall. All kinds of these problems everywhere. We see a continuing decline in the labor force participation rate. And the conservatives say, well, it's just because they can get so much welfare and they don't want to work. That's all BS. There's no jobs for them. They search and search and search. They can't find a job. They give up. They're no longer counted as unemployed. So we have a very curious situation where the unemployment rate has come down hand in hand with a decline in the labor force participation rate. So the whole, there's no economy here. It's not anything here. We have massive budget deficits. There's no way to close them. They're talking about taking away health care benefits, cutting back Social Security pensions, and also they can go on with endless wars. So there's no economy here. It's all held together with rigging. And they keep the dollar up because they got the Japanese central bank printing money. They've got the European central bank printing money. Those are the other two big currencies. So if they're all printing too, the dollar doesn't look bad. Yeah. So yeah, you could have a collapse.
Yeah, and everything you've described to me there is described by the mainstream as recovery. We're constantly told how the U.S. is recovering.
They produce the recovery by not counting unemployment, and they produce the recovery by not counting inflation. So they just don't measure either one. The unemployment number of 5.6% or whatever it is counts no discouraged worker. And there are millions of discouraged workers. And the inflation, well, the way they measure inflation, if the price of something goes up, they throw it out of the index and put something in that's cheaper. If the price of something goes up, they say it's not a price rise, it's a quality improvement. They don't count it. So that's how they get low inflation. And they get low unemployment by not counting anybody that hasn't searched for a job in the last 4 weeks. So if you've been searching for a job for 4 years and can't find one, and you haven't searched in the last 4 weeks, you are not counted as unemployed. So the figures are useless. That's what they use to claim that there's a recovery. There's no other figures that support recovery. Not home sales, not median family income, not retail sales, not housing starts. Nothing supports the image of recovery. It's just more propaganda.
So you're characterizing this as a house of cards, and you're saying that
it's a house of
that cards. There's every possibility that it could in fact be this year that that house of cards collapses. Now, if it does, then of course, as you said in a previous interview, that would bring the wars to an end? Would they no longer be able to finance those wars? And what would happen at home? How would people cope with such a collapse?
I don't know. You see, we now have a militarized police, and this new Nazi Gestapo department called Department of Homeland Security, which is a federal thing, it now has the very unusual and probably unconstitutional right to take over state and local police forces. And according to government contract documents, Washington has spent $385 million on Halliburton building detention centers. So I have no idea. It's an amazing situation. And then, and I don't know if this is true, but the other day on Alex Jones, they've published a report that they now have documents that the United States Army has plans to occupy Texas and Utah because they have so many libertarians and so many people alienated from Washington. This may all just be nonsense, but it fits the whole pattern that we see of all kinds of expansion of federal police military powers over the population. You can go into small towns now, and the local police have tanks, armored personnel carriers, helicopters, rocket-propelled grenades. It's an amazing thing. Just small little country town police forces. So why did they have all this? There's no reason, but they have it.
Well, I was speaking, was it last year or the year before, to a lawyer called Kurt Haskell, who had seen he believed to be a false flag event, and he was saying how he thought that this build-up of the police state he said was going on in the U.S. was so bad that he was going to get out of the country, and I believe he has done now.
Yeah, a lot of people want to get out, and they think about it, and they tell me I should. My view is that Americans are now so hated everywhere in the world that you're simply not safe, because once American power cracks, the rest of the world are going to turn on Americans, unless you can marry into some prominent family and acquire protection that way. These American expatriate communities, they're in danger because the world simply hates the United States, and thereby it spills over into Americans, even the ones that don't like the country and have left it. And you know how these things work, you know, the people are scapegoated. And the minute the United States looks like it's not able or willing to protect these expatriate communities, people are going to turn on them. They're going to be scapegoated, particularly if we use nuclear weapons on somebody, or we overthrow Venezuela or Bolivia or Ecuador or Argentina, as we're trying to do. And Americans are not going to be safe. They're not going to be safe here, but they're not going to be safe anywhere else either.
Well, you've answered my question as regards the domestic situation if there's a collapse. What about the international situation? Do you think the wars could continue if they couldn't be financed in the traditional way?
I don't think the wars can continue if Europe would put its foot down, because Washington has to have cover. If it doesn't have cover, it's a war criminal. And so that's why we always go to all this extreme length to get a coalition of the willing or NATO. Or it's a way of justifying what, under the Nuremberg standard, is a war crime punished by death. So as to avoid that type of charge, Washington organizes its puppets, the stupid Prime Minister of England, the Chancellor of Germany, the President of France, the rest of these puppets. What interest does Europe have in defending Georgia, somewhere way off in the Caucasus? None. What interest does Europe have in the former Soviet Central Asian republics? None. But why are they mobilized for this type of thing? So if the Europeans just said no, or they said, you know what, we think NATO is a bigger danger to us than the Russians are, which it is, because the Russians are not going to attack Europe, but NATO may get pushed into conflict with Europe. So if the Europeans could just find an ounce of intelligence and an ounce of courage and just say no, put the foot down, then how's Washington going to go forward with this? They wouldn't even have any staging grounds for their armies to push them up against the Russian borders. The whole thing would be over with. I mean, really, NATO needs to end. I wrote several years ago, there's no need for NATO. If it didn't exist, we wouldn't be facing the prospect of a nuclear war. There wouldn't be any conflict. The United States couldn't do any of these things. It has to have this cover. It gets the British to go fight for it in Afghanistan and in Iraq. What in the world is that in Britain's interest for? None.
And do you see any movement in this direction? Do you see any of these hopeful signs, what we've been talking about?
The only movement we've seen, Julian, you know, it's Hollande and Merkel going to Putin and dragging along the puppet in Kiev and working out the Minsk agreement. And so the Russians are keeping to it, the breakaway republics are keeping to it, but we don't let Kiev keep to it. We keep telling the puppet, no, 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 and they keep breaking and breaking and breaking. And so what's going to happen? The telling tale will be whether Merkel and Hollande say something about this and simply say that Washington has to quit trying to break up this agreement or we're leaving NATO. Or they have to tell the Washington puppet in Kiev that you do stay to this, because now you answer to us, not just to the Americans.
How likely do you think any of that is?
I don't know. It depends on what threat Merkel and Hollande perceive from causing a war with Russia. If they think that the idiot Americans are going to force them into a war with Russia, they're likely to break away, even if they can be blackmailed. But if they think that, well, tomorrow the Americans will change their mind, and they don't, but they think, well, the next week they will, or the next month, or we'll stay with this, and if we break, we'll lose our influence. As long as we're cooperating with Americans, we can still talk to them. You never know what kind of delusions people work themselves into, do you, Julian? I mean,
No. So the whole The picture I'm getting is the whole thing is on knife edge.
It's on knife edge.
In various ways.
Yeah.
A movement in the way that you've just described, or a knife edge that moves over into a first strike, or a knife edge of the economy in the US, and you just don't know which way it's going to go.
That's right. Flip. We don't know. There are potentials for disaster, and there are potentials for the empire to break up, the American empire to break up. Now, that's a term that Americans don't understand. If I mention the American empire, they don't have like idea what you're talking about. What empire? What do you mean? We don't have an empire. They think you're some kind of a nutcase, or they say, well, you must be anti-American. We don't have empires.
That's certainly a great difference from here. There is a consciousness of the American empire, for sure.
Well, you've experienced it for years now, haven't you? Decades. I mean, you've probably had three generations of people moving through the American empire.
Well, I mean, I'm going to say it's been a pleasure to speak with you, Dr. Roberts. I mean, in one sense, it has, because, you know, it's great to hear your view on things and the way in which you do make so much sense out of what's happening. I mean, you watch the mainstream and, you know, you're just insulted over and over again in various ways. So it is a great pleasure to speak with you because of your clarity and your experience on these things. But then on the other hand, there is this... Well, this sense of gloom, which is realistic, you don't know which way things are going, and it could be absolutely appalling. And of course, I accept what you say. We are in extremely dangerous times. But nevertheless, I do thank you for coming on. And as I've said before, the listeners very much appreciate your input to the program. So,
Julian, let me apologize to your listeners for being so exasperated.
I think that's fair enough.
I know I sound extremely exasperated. I shouldn't sound that way. I should just be very low-key, speak in a very neutral voice. But I really am exasperated with it. It's just amazing to watch the world move toward destruction because of a handful of neocon Nazis. And nobody will call the whistle on. Nobody will blow the whistle on. It's all just one propaganda after another. You know, we're really in times that are worse than those described by George Orwell in 1984. The spying is more complete. The control is more complete. The lack of awareness on the part of the populations is more total. And the mendacity of the government is worse than that portrayed in 1984. So it's a very exasperating thing. You know, I sometimes wish I had not had all the experiences that I had and didn't know all the things that I know and could just be happy piddling around on the beach or having fun in the mountains.
Well, I'm so glad you're not like that, because then all of us would suffer by not having your interpretation of what's going on. Of course, we wouldn't know the truth of so much that we're being lied to about. So I wouldn't wish you to be any other way. And I thank you very much for being candid on this program, because I think people will very much appreciate what you've said. And I thank you very much for all the work that you continue to do at paulcraigroberts.org. And thank you again for spending this time with us on the show.
Well, Julian, I appreciate your interest. And all the best to you and your listeners.
Thank you ever so much for coming on. Great to speak to you.
Okay, Julian. Well, don't wait a year next time. Or maybe that's all your listeners can take. They probably can't take it more than once a year.
Well, I thought you were going to say maybe we haven't got a year. So, but that's.
Well, you know, it's not clear we do, Julian. It's not clear.
Yeah.
Okay. All the best to you.
Thank you ever so much. And I shall be in touch within the year, God willing.
God willing. Okay. So long.
Well, thanks very much for listening to that very stirring and informative interview with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. It's certainly a great privilege for me to be able to speak with such a person. And I look forward to inviting Dr. Roberts back on the show in future. There are a couple of things that I do want to say before we close. The first is that please don't forget that we have this debate coming up on the subject of Mormonism. If any of you do have questions, please don't forget to send them in via the contact form or using voicemail. I also do have one of Dr. Bennett's books left to give away. So for those of you who did listen to that interview with Dr. Robert Bennett, please do let me know if any of you would like to have that book. It is available. And as I said last time, if any of you do use iTunes, I would still be grateful for more comments and ratings there, because it does apparently help with the visibility of the show. And I can't tell you how encouraging it is when people do make comments there. It is a real boost and is part and parcel of helping to keep people going in alternative media. So thanks again to those of you who have done that, and I'll be very grateful for some more support in that way. So that's it for today. I will say that there isn't going to be a normal podcast next week, or indeed the week after, because, of course, it's the Easter break. But I am intending to post a couple of mystery items during that time. That's all I'm going to say for the moment, but do keep a lookout for those. You may find those interesting. So that's it for today. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, for the mindrenewed.com, and I wish you a very blessed Easter. And I look forward to speaking to you again in the very near future.